whenever you're in that situation, I want something, I've got money, but there's too much friction, flip it around, and that's an entrepreneurial, possibly an entrepreneurial opportunity if you can make that stuff easy. So as we talked about it in that framing, it was exciting.
Hey, it's Adam Schoenfeld. Welcome back to the Built in Seattle podcast, where Seattle's top entrepreneurs, investors, and leaders share their stories and their lessons from behind the scenes. If you like this show, then you'll love my short weekly email, the Pike Street Journal. Subscribe at psj.email. Each week I send some bonus nuggets from these interviews, stuff I get when the recorder's off, and some more insider takes on Seattle people and companies. That's psj.email. On this episode, I met with Joe Heitzberg. He's the CEO and co-founder at CrowdCow. CrowdCow's been in the news a ton for helping people discover high-quality meat online. As you can imagine, they've really accelerated with the pandemic. Joe talked about the early days of CrowdCow, how he validated the business, how he got PR without actually doing PR, and as a serial entrepreneur, what he's doing different this time around. I hope you enjoy the conversation. I'm here with the one, the only, Joe Heitzberg. Hey, Joe, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm excited to dig in with you today because I know CrowdCow has been in the news a bunch. And now it almost seems like an obvious thing that needs to exist today, but I'm curious to start by asking you, how contrarian was this idea 5 years ago when you started?
It was very contrarian, I guess, if that's the right word. It really hurt for a little, because we did have some people like literally laugh at us. What are you guys doing? What's that thing? And we'd explain and they'd laugh like, you're kidding me. And then that kind of hurt. But most people actually said, no, seriously, what are you really working on? It was like, oh God. There were very few people who actually said, that's a great idea, or who were in the investor community, or I would say my tech friends community. But the thing that we were hearing from like our customers was, this kicks ass. Oh my God, thank you. And then many of those people who laughed at us also would turn around and place orders and then tell their friends. And so we just kept going, knowing that it was resonating.
What was the earliest elevator pitch that people laughed at?
It was definitely, what if there was a website where you virtually can meet the farmer and there's maybe a video and there's like a little diagram of a cow. And you each buy a piece of the cow. And when all the pieces are sold, the cow tips and you become a stakeholder. And then we ship it out. It shows at your door. And people would laugh and go, oh my God. And then, oh, that's awesome. Cause that's, I want that better beef. I want that connection to a farmer. That's Portlandia in a iPhone app. Give it to me. We had a very strong positive reaction to that. That's how we in fact tested the whole company. We first tested on friends with that exact elevator pitch, just to be like, hey, we're thinking about this idea. What do you think? And people were like, that's awesome. Then we went to a Starbucks, the one down from Madrona's office down in downtown. I just went up to strangers and was like, excuse me, sir, may I talk to you? Do you eat beef? Well, we're working on a product idea. What do you think about this? And we'd give the pitch. And a lot of people actually said, oh, that's really cool. What's the URL? I want to write this down. And you actually rarely get that kind of great positive feedback on an idea. Usually get questions and concerns or feigned interest, but it was real interest. And so we thought, hey, let's give it a shot.
So you literally just went downstairs to a Starbucks and started asking people if this was an interesting idea or if they would buy it.
Yeah.
How early was that in the process? And what were the questions that you were trying to validate or answer at that point?
That would have been around March or April of 2015. And we shipped the first cow by, it was just the weekend of July 4th. But we talked to maybe 10, 15 strangers. And it was like that reaction. Almost everyone was like that. Or they were like, I'll never do that. I'm a vegetarian, or that kind of a reaction. So we just felt like there's something there. And if you get people talking, okay, you're interested. Well, why? What makes you feel that way? Why are you excited? Whatever. People would laugh and smile at the concept of buying a cow online or whatever, but then they would immediately gravitate towards the, yeah, I know I've heard that people do that, but you're making it easier. I know that beef is better. I want to try it. Or I think it's important. I've heard how screwed the industry is and I want to fix it. And they went to these higher level concepts, or I want a healthier product. I'm on this kind of diet and I have trouble finding meat that's not with hormones or whatever. And I want that assurance. And so it immediately went from like smile to I want that to like, this is going to be meaningful in my life in a deeper way. And when you have elevator pitches that resonate that strongly with people, you're onto something.
So you said that there were people laughing at you. Were those mostly like other tech people and people in the VC community, or who was laughing?
I was doing Madrona Venture Labs, and we had done, I think it was like a year and a half, $2 million entity to prototype companies and Madrona Venture Labs itself. When we were negotiating coming to the end of that first fund, I was like, I want to do something. So Ethan and I had already gotten together and started a list of startup ideas. And we were systematically testing all these ideas on different criteria, as one does, your spreadsheet. But when we were in that process, of course, we were talking to our friends about lots of different ideas, and as you do. And I think when we got to, I don't know, I kind of like this one the best, and I think I'm getting the best signal in as we researched the market opportunity, especially. We thought, yeah, I think we're going to do this. So when we circled back to those friends, the entrepreneur friends that we all have, and said, I think we're going to do that. They're like, aha, really? No, really, what are you going to do? I knew that was one of the things you were dinking around with, but that can't be the winner. There were five other better ideas on that list of reaction.
I heard the story that it was a coworker that had, you know, purchased a cow and came into the office and was really excited about it. And that kind of wasn't on your initial spreadsheet. So I'm curious about the spreadsheet process versus the spontaneity of arriving at the idea for CrowdCow. How far were you into the spreadsheet and the, hey, we need to vet lots of different ideas? Like, how long had that been you landed on this?
It depends how you measure it. We did a Kickstarter project. I don't know if you remember that or know about that, but we'd gone pretty deep down one path, which was even a year before Madrona Venture Labs, we were working together on the idea of like hardware itself was becoming with Kickstarter to fund things and hardware companies in China becoming almost like as a service, a thing you could tap into. And online, you can get talent and design, and you can do marketing and sales with e-commerce platforms. It was like, wow, you can build hardware products, cloud connected, and the hardware is so cheap. You could pick up an Android tablet in China, this was 6 years ago, for $40. So if you follow that curve out, you're like, wow, hardware is going to be free, and it's all going to be about cloud software. That's an enormous opportunity. That's a huge trend. Let's go. We were looking also to do something that we hadn't done before, a new domain where you'd have to learn, have an adventure. That was one of the criteria. Mm-hmm. And so we were down that path deep, but then we had decided, no, hardware's for companies like Samsung and Apple. Let's not do hardware for various reasons. So we come back to this list, and to answer your question, we were pretty deep on it. We had another complete idea, like a tool prototyped running, customers using it, private beta style, for a little while, that we killed when the side conversation of CrowdCow came up and we started testing it, and it took over.
You said that one of the criteria was that you wanted to learn something new and have an adventure. What were the other columns in the spreadsheet?
They weren't the right ones, because one of the reasons why we chose CrowdCow became added once we dug in. For me, it was like, some of the columns were things like, are we the right founders for the idea? Or I always have, are you in the money flow? I think there are a lot of great startups, and some of them become very successful, but they've got to innovate the business model, or the business model's not really test. It's, you have to test it. I like things where business model's not tested at all. Like, you're providing a service where money's already changing hands like crazy, and you're just coming in to take some of it, and your disruption is from the tech or something else. I like those. So that was one of them. Another one was, gosh, could we do it? Are we interested in it? There was, can we validate it? And what have we learned during the validation step, and to kind of rank things towards the top. But we added things like, for me, one of the big ones was, we both had kids, Ethan's kids, and my son was like 5 years old at the time, and his were just like 6 and 8 or something. So with young children, do you really want to be doing blockchain validated SaaS millennial credit card thingies? You know, do you want to do like a platform, or do you want to do something that your kid can relate to? And for me, it was like 5 years old. I don't know if you have kids, but 5 years old is where they really start to figure out how the world fits together. Not just, oh, I touched this, it's hot, ouch, that hurts, but like in deeper ways. And I felt, gosh, if we're going to be diving into a startup again, it's going to be really hard work, all consuming. And as I thought about, you feel this tension of, you want to be the best father in the world, but you want to be the best entrepreneur in the world too. And so as I reconciled that, it was like, if I can do something that he can relate to directly and be part of, So it's clicked. Wow, he can visit the farms with me and get a appreciation of where his food comes from. I'll be the kick-ass dad of the world because he'll probably be the only kid at school that's been to a slaughter or literally delivered orders to our neighbors together, the e-commerce orders in the early days, or he could go help pack orders. He could help taste test ranches. He could participate in almost all of the company. And that was really important to me. Demonstrate a work ethic, show entrepreneurship in action at a young age and inspire him and that he could relate to it in a meaningful way. And I had that same upbringing. My mom was a software engineer and she had her own software company running out of our basement. I realized that as much as I probably wouldn't want to have admitted it earlier in life, that totally influenced everything I did. I found myself racing through the schoolwork to go work on my own little project in my basement kind of attitude. And so I want him to have that same inspiration. I want to work hard. I want it to be successful, not at his expense, but to his benefit.
Does Ethan have a similar mindset around that? Was that something you guys were aligned on at the start?
Definitely. And one of the reasons to start the company was Ethan's wife is actually a vegetarian. So one of the...
Oh, funny.
The conversation was like, yeah, from the friend who was buying like a whole cow from a farm and had a huge meat freezer, was like, yeah, I want that meat, but I don't want to buy a meat freezer. And Ethan was like, yeah, I'm never going to do that. Nicole's a vegetarian. So it was like, wait a minute, whenever you want something really bad and you have money you're willing to pay, but to get it, you've got to drive a truck somewhere and it's confusing and you got to buy a meat freezer. There's so much friction. Whenever you're in that situation, I want something, I've got money, but there's too much friction. Flip it around. And that's possibly an entrepreneurial opportunity if you can make that stuff easy. So as we talked about it in that framing, it was exciting. And as we looked at the market, and then when we did our first real scary moment of the company, after vetting the idea was real, we're like, okay, now we're going to take the next step. We're going to build a website and make it look as real as possible without actually being real. It takes money. To answer your earlier question, your friends will tell you it's a great idea. We got to really get their money to approve it. So put the payment page up and the minimal stuff and make it look as real as, and then launch it. We really got a farm. We had to do the real work. So before we do all that work, if we are not successful, what's our downside? And our downside was, I guess we're going to buy a cow and you and I will have a lot of meat. Not a bad downside. And we'll call it quits. Let's do it. So it made it easy.
Is that something you were looking for a cognizance of, like that asymmetrical profile of limited downside experiments that have, you know, potentially huge upside? Was that something you were intentionally thinking about?
Yeah. At Madrona Venture Labs, we had to be very intentional about those types of processes because, let's face it, you've got a small group of people and you're going to come up with some startup idea and then you want to hand it off to someone else to run and you want to keep equity and you want to do that quickly. That's the business model, right? So as you think through the dynamics of that, like you're a founder, hey, I've got this thing, I've been working on it for 3 months. You want to take it and I'll keep a good chunk of the equity? Doesn't sound like a great deal. So we had to work really hard on being intentional about what we were going to choose to do and how we were going to generate proof around these things so that an entrepreneur would say, yeah, I'll take it. You know, and that included like, here's 10 other ideas we threw away in the last year, and this is one that we're not. And or this has tangible proof, signed up customers, real revenue, whatever. So I think that's all. That we were very intentional about CrowdCon in that same way. I think we borrowed that same learning. So how can we validate this without building anything? That was phase one, because that's quickest. Who do we talk to? How do we pretend? And then if we build something, start with the demand side, not the supply side. Maybe do a little research, like how many of these farms are there and how big is the market, just directionally. But then let's test the demand, validate it. Because you got nothing if you can't get some sales immediately. So what's the minimal thing we build on the landing page and stuff to get money? And then if we achieve success there, we have a good problem to have because we're going to have to spend the next month actually getting product shipped and figuring out all that stuff. So we priced it enough to like, we thought we would make some money and cover some of the costs, but we didn't know what most of those costs even were at that point.
No, I love that how you just incrementally went through those questions to validate it. Do you think that other founders should be thinking more like a labs or an accelerator in those early stage? Was that, you know, helpful for you guys to take that approach?
Yeah, I think it's advice I always give. That's one of my biggest learnings from labs, because our product was companies. We had to think about how to make the process of making companies efficiently and proving them out decisively. But you can apply those same lessons to your own startup ideas. I think I was a software major, yes, a computer science major and a programmer. So my lens on the world early on in my entrepreneurial, you know, career was go build stuff, prototype, right? You got the idea of go prototype. And that's not always the fastest route to validating whether it's a good idea.
Yeah. So I want to talk about how the validation looked and felt. I read or listened somewhere else that you got to $1 million of sales and your initial traction very quickly. So I'm curious just how strong and fast did the market pull for CrowdCow after you had done some of this initial validation, after you got to actually shipping a real product people could pay for? How did the pull from the market look at that point?
It was pretty fast. It was in the first, from that June till the end of that year, 2015, I think it was $60,000 in revenue. We were shipping, maybe at first it was like we did one, and then a month later we did another cow. And by the way, I just have to say, because people confuse us, thanks to the name, but today we don't do that model. We sell beef, pork, chicken, seafood, one e-commerce basket. But we literally were selling one cow at a time in the beginning, kind of crowdfund style. So it was like one cow, and then a month later, another one. And then our next goal is a week, once a week, because that's a forcing function. What is it going to take to do once a week? All the logistics and operations of the website, and the marketing machine, that was and then it was once a day. And I remember once a day came after the 6 months, Mark. And I remember thinking, wow, once a day, that's going to be really hard. I don't know how we do that. I remember impossibly hard. Oh, man, I don't know if we'll ever make it. But then at some point after that first 6 months, it just took on a life of its own. And I remember we were getting press, major press. Turns out, hey, people used to ask, how do you get all this press? Who's your agency or your PR person? Or like, what? How did you do it? And they're like, it's easy. Sell cows on the internet. I think there's a lesson in that. The product of press is a good entertaining story. So we had a great entertaining story that was also very relevant to a lot of big trends in terms of sustainability and food systems and so forth. So we started getting press. And of course, we had the viral dynamic of customers telling their friends to rally the cow, to tip the cow to become a stakeholder. And it just grew and grew to where the demand took a life of its own. And then we entered a phase all the way through our seed round where we were just supply constrained in terms of execution. We were totally bootstrapped. I think Ethan and I had put in like $50,000 each or something just to pay bills and whatever, not paying ourselves a salary. Now we're employing people, but all contract, and just try to make it work. And very frustratingly, we would launch an event and email 10% of our email list, because if we emailed more than that, the whole thing would sell out in 1 hour, and it would just piss people off. For a while there, it was like that. And we knew we were onto something, and we just had to be silent and execute really hard. And we got a seed round done and started to build from there.
Had you ever felt pull like that to that extreme before, where you actually had to limit the people you're emailing and the press was coming in organically to that extent?
No, to be honest. I've always felt, I think, I've done two-sided marketplace stuff and I've done viral social stuff, but actually, no, I did in Snapvine, my first out of business school company, we had a viral coefficient above one, crazy. First board meeting, we're launching our product. Second board meeting, we have over 1 million users. I was like, I felt it then too. Those are the two times in my entire career where I felt like, whoa. The rest of the whole experiences of it is always feels a little bit like you're pushing. I think we're all familiar with that.
Oh, yeah. What were the conversations like between you and Ethan then when you felt the pull mounting and you were so supply constrained?
We were talking. It was like having a live chat open all day long, all night long, every day. I mean, it was like, because we had, it's like atoms and molecules, or it's like real product, physical, perishable, and farmers and shipments. And it's not just digital anymore, which is what was exciting and challenging and fun. And really rewarding. People are feeling and tasting your product and your service. But it also meant in the early days, we were set up within a butcher part. We convinced a butcher to let us have part of his freezer for free. so that we could train him to pack orders and enable an online business. And so we'd have to drive out there once a week, take a ferry to his location. It was a pain in the ass, hauling stuff in the back of the car, all the boxes and whatever that we'd have to order and pick up. And then we'd sit there and we'd pack orders with one of their staff members with at a stack of like printouts of the orders printed on paper with all the orders. We'd take a black marker and line through the items as we pack them. And then after that exhausting thing, we would go home and build the software to try to make a digital process for that that was foolproof. And we just did that while also keeping up with demand and the marketing for so long. And then we moved into our own sublet freezer in a bigger facility, and we had staff. And I wasn't the one packing the orders with Ethan, but it was other people. But if something breaks or somebody quits on you, how hard is it? Let me tell you how hard it is to hire somebody to just work 2 days a week and be dependable. So there's scale breakpoints that you have to push through. It is so hard. It's like, we're at a scale where I can hire two people for 2 days a week. That's slim pickings on who wants that job. And so if they don't show up for work, you're packing. Or if the server bug that you coded up a new feature and you didn't debug it all the way and it broke. I was waking up every Monday at 5 a.m. to look at the server and see if anything broke as they were packing. If something would break, I'd try to fix it. And if I couldn't break it, I'd have to drive down there because it might be on the local computer or router or the print server that was in the facility. I have to go down there and debug it, plug into the network.
Oh my God.
You know, in a freezer, it's freezing cold. It's just, the first 2 years of the company were what I described there.
It's so interesting operating that dimension of the physical things and something that you can see and smell and taste, and like it really flowed through everything, it sounds like.
Extremely rewarding and challenging at the same time.
I looked on the site just this morning, and now obviously it's totally different. You've got, I don't know if it's dozens or hundreds of different items. You can get seafood and chicken and everything.
Yeah.
Did you know then that this is where it was heading and it was just a matter of powering through those scale breakpoints, or was it more organic? And what was the thinking about the future back then?
I think we had some, I'm a big believer of like, have a vision and a North Star, but then have hypotheses and test and get there as you go. And you've got to be willing to tweak and turn as you go, heat seeking missile style. So of course we'd considered like, where could this be? How big could it go? It could be all the categories. But let's test our way in, and when is the right time to do it? Is it a distraction to launch the next protein? When you're early, you're just beef. Is it a distraction to try to do pork? And if we're still crowdfunding cows, do we do Three Little Piggies? Sorry, I had to put a joke out. Is it a distraction, or is it going to increase our share of wallet? Because people do want more than just beef. And I think we ultimately concluded it's going to increase retention and repeat and LTV if we have the full meat drawer. So vision was actually very early on. We want to be the one place that people buy all their meats. And we've got to stair-step our way to get there. As a small-scale company competing with super-scale, very cheap incumbents that are broken in many ways, we got to carve out our niche and get there over time. But over time, we've kept that North Star to the point where if we can be the one place where you buy all your meats, then we should be able to be a better meat, but not a financial burden. And as we work through that, we can, you know, have our assortment that's incredible all the way to the A5 Wagyu, but also have stuff that's like price competitive with what you'd otherwise be getting at grocery, and overall an assortment that's way better. You said, do we have dozens or hundreds? Many hundreds of products. Our assortment is absolutely the best of any online meat thing out there, for sure.
It's incredible in such a short time to have gone from crowdsource a single cow to that. But it makes sense in context of the North Star. Where are you with the business? What can you share in terms of the scale of the business, however you like to talk about it? How much money have you raised? What's the kind of current stage and state?
Yeah. So we're 5.5 years old, about 90 people now. We've raised $25 million, which is pretty lean. I won't share the revenue, but it's lean for the revenue and the growth. Hundreds of suppliers, independent farms, beef, pork, chicken, seafood, sustainable wild cut, Copper River salmon, first run, Alaska, but also ASC certified at the highest level, sustainable farm raised salmon from middle of nowhere, Norway. And then the first and ever fair trade certified blue shrimp down in Mexico. And of course, we are actually the largest single retailer of beef from Japan, of the A5 Wagyu in the country. So we've got this incredible assortment, but most of it is United States of America, small farms, heritage pork, pasture-raised chicken, and a grass-fed and grain-finished beef from independent producers.
Very cool. Joe, you've done this before, as has Ethan. What is it that you guys wanted to do differently this time around, especially now as you're entering the kind of company building, scaling stage? What do you want to have be different this time in terms of building the business and the culture?
I think what's different for me, I guess I'll put it this way, taking the long view. What feels different about this one versus, oh, this is something that's happening and we've got a little angle. Let's just iterate, build and iterate, which is a very typical like startup-y thing to do. It's great and it's fun. And with this one, we had that, but we also had this eyes on like this big old industry that controls the thing and it's worth $200 billion. That's a huge market. And when I go to the store and hit the meat counter, it's super boring and lame. There's no marketing and no branding and no excitement and no storytelling. And you don't know where it comes from. And you flip on Netflix and they're telling you that it's destroying the planet. So it felt like maybe if we take the long view, there's a play we can chip away at this and actually make a positive impact in a big category. It's big enough. Doesn't seem like anybody's doing it. Let's go for it. I felt that was the difference. And so it was like, yeah, we can start with this funny like crowdfund thing and iterate. We can do all the stuff we know how to do really well. But if we just keep the long view and be patient, build a great company, because the mission is so powerful. And I've, you know, never had a company that had such a powerful mission. That's a difference too. But we've got this big, giant opportunity at the other side too. So that's really exciting. I think after so many startups, and I've had some small wins along the way, but like it does afford you to take the long view a little bit more and you learn from your successes and mistakes. So I was looking for something we could do. We were looking for something we could do for a little longer and keep it for the long run and not just always be looking for the next go to the next shiny object.
How has being able to take that long view and have this powerful mission changed the way you work or the decisions you make day to day?
I don't know. I've never had a company get this far. So in that sense, I'm still learning and learning every day. I think one of the biggest changes for me, I've done a lot of early stage, obviously with Madrona Venture Labs, where I had a bootstrap company that I sold after 2 years. But now it becomes much more about my definition of success as an entrepreneur. Ultimately, you can remember the napkin moment, but you build towards something that doesn't need you involved, that its impact and its ability to live on outlives you. That's a high level definition of success for me that I have for startups versus do one, do the next thing. So I always keep that in mind. It's, I want to hire great people, I'll enable them, and I want to fortify the business so that it's not. But as you also probably know, every startup in its first 5 years always feels like you're just fighting to justify your existence all the time.
For sure.
But we're starting to reach that point where I no longer, as founders, we don't look at each other and go, okay, hey, what are the likely scenarios where we sit right now? The first one's obviously we just die. Here's another one. Here's another one. Now it's like that we're just going to die is not one of the scenarios. So I feel like we've accomplished something in 5 years. So now it's like that affords us to look even bigger.
In doing that, what values in the culture or how you work have you been most intentional about in building into the company at this point?
Ownership mentality is a big one. That's, you've got to, and by the way, you've got to hire by your values, obviously, and live by the values and emphasize them all the time. But for us, ownership mentality is a big one. This is complicated because you've got logistics, you've got marketing, you've got vendors, you've got small farms, you've got freight, you've got to model the numbers. We're getting to a scale where all this matters. And so if everyone in every seat doesn't take like ownership mentality, things could fall through in a way that would break the machine or not work ultimately. And having a strong mission makes a big difference in that. Win as a team. We all work hard and we're all playing to win, but we win together. So we don't end up with a hero culture or politics because of that one, I think. We have a succeed through partners value, which is really important. It's like we don't exist to help small farms. We do help some small farms, but we don't exist for that. We're together in partnership with small farms doing something that's really valuable for the industry and for consumers. And so we have to be really selective about making sure that we're working really hard and the partner's working really hard to like joint success. So that's like that's a really important one too. Just to name a few that have, I think, helped us.
When you started this, did you have any idea of the inner workings of a small farm or what their business is like or what the opportunity was to serve them?
No, I still learn every day. And I was, like I said, I spent this last weekend in Arkansas with a chicken farm and it was awesome. And I learned a lot. Every time I spend a lot of time with farms, I learn something. It's really amazing.
Anything surprising or cool that you learned out in Arkansas at the chicken farm?
I learned a lot about chicken breeds on that one. It's 99% or more of the chicken in America is this Cornish cross hen, this breed that's been, you've heard about it like in the 90s or 80s. It was like the industry, it became industrialized. And so they just, through selective breeding, they created chickens that grew three times faster than when they started. So these little chickens in 5 or 6 weeks put on so much fat and muscle, so it's more economical, right? The problem is they can barely walk at the end of that. So for many people, that's inherently inhumane. Like, we've gone too far, we the industrial chicken guys, we as a society. Why did we let this happen? Why did we want chicken so bad that we allowed us to breed it in an industrial way to where the chickens suffer because they just get too big too fast? So these guys we're working with have gone back to the heritage breeds and created a new breeding program, which they've been running for 12 years, to create a chicken that grows slow and you can feed it different things, not just soy and corn. And because of that, these chickens are vibrant. They run around, they flap, they bathe in the dust. They're happy. And you can see it. They're happy. They can run literally wherever they want. They like to stay together. So they let them out and they spend all day outside. There are no fences. They can run. It's a huge farm. And they can just run wherever they want. They can go under the brush and down in the gully to the streams. And it's incredible. From what I understand, like a mature Cornish cross chicken that you find everywhere in every store, it won't even do that. It won't go outside because it can't walk. That's one thing I learned.
That's crazy.
And it tastes better.
Totally.
You got it going for you.
I'm picturing this Seattle tech guy with a software and engineering background going out to all these farms. And I've got to ask, like, how did you build trust or get these folks to open up to you and become a true partner to the business along the way?
Well, it was hard at first. I think we were interesting to them. I don't think they get too many tech people. We were credible enough that they would talk to us. And they probably don't get that many people in their daily life who come out and want to sit and spend a day and talk about their business and ours and our vision. But it was hard at first to actually even get some that wanted to even work with us, to be honest, because we were, some of these really small farms were like, I can see where this plays out. I start selling you cattle. You're doing well for a while. And then you change or you pivot or you go out of business. And then I'm stuck with like, how do I sell those 7 cows per month? I got to go back to how I was doing it before and I've lost customers. And so that was very difficult. But I think at some point, once you're written up all over in the press and you can show them your traction and build trust by earning it that way, it becomes easier. And then it becomes, the economics get better for everybody and it becomes just obvious. And there's a spectrum. You got to know that a farm to try to do e-commerce is like a non-starter. You've got a full-time job raising animals. Now you've got to buy dry ice and hire people to pack your orders and the economics don't work and it's only one day a week and all the problems that we already had in the beginning, we outgrew. And I buy dry ice for 15 cents a pound. If you were doing once a week a few orders, you'd be paying $1 a pound, these kinds of things. And so we have real value to bring in and aggregating all the demand. And oh, by the way, people don't want to buy a half a freezer of meat. They want to buy the seasonal seafood item and a couple steaks and some hamburger and a gift box for their friend. That convenience that we offer by aggregating it all together in one platform is huge too. So they have AI and we have AI. They have artificial insemination and we have artificial intelligence. I respect that their world is that complicated and awesome. And we want to shine the light on them, tell their story. Consumers love that. And we've got a bunch of stuff that's secret sauce that's, you know, it's a win-win partner.
What's a mistake that you've made in scaling that's changed the way you think or how you work? You mentioned that you've done a number of startups, but this one's kind of scaled past where you'd been recently.
Yeah.
I'm curious what's changed your mindset or the way you operate.
I think one of the biggest challenges, and it's probably not just us, but for really any company, and you've been through this too, I'm sure, because you get simply measured was, I think when I visited your office, you were over 100 people and you'd grown really fast. There's a point where like when you're like 5 or 6 or 7 or even like 12 people, you want total athletes willing to do anything you have to and talented across many different domains and work really hard and learn fast and scrappy and many of those qualities you want in everybody always. But there's a point where you hop over to like, no, I need vertical experts. We just need a person to nail this one. We figured out this one thing is important. So we just need somebody who's been there, done that on that thing and can scale beyond it and so forth. But do you know what I mean? That's a really hard one. And we had such an operationally intense business. And frankly, Ethan and I had not much experience in it. We were learning on the job that I think hiring like somebody from the cold chain logistics or procurement, sourcing, you name it, fulfillment, Amazon stuff earlier would have been very helpful versus us trying to learn. Another one would be on the merchandising and sourcing and how do you work. Like it's one thing to knock on farmers' doors and do a deal, but it's a different thing to forecast out a few months and work on a larger calendar and to create like a pricing thing that works and to map demand to how much inventory do we want to hold and how do we, that's a whole different skill set as well as the front end website, merchandising, experimentation, A/B testing. It's called merchants. There are a lot of them, just go hire some. And I think at some point in the company, we realized we had a team of people that weren't merchants. They were like us. They were jack of all trades learning on the job and they're doing a great job, but we'd benefit by bringing in some professional talent in certain areas. And I think it's a hard one because you can't hire those people too early either. That can be a mistake. How do you time it?
What's the balance that you found now on that as you're growing the team to the next level?
Still finding it. Yeah. It's a constant juggling act. I think in part because as we scale, you reach different breakpoints and you have to step back from the business and go, okay, wow, this is fundamentally different now. We have this other set of opportunities.
Mm. So it's more about asking that question at those points to figure out how to shift the balance or shift the talent.
What's changed is I'm spending a lot more time outside the company talking to people at a stage or two ahead of us to learn and talk about here's where we're at. I'm thinking maybe it's going to go here or there. What would you do? And they point me in the right direction and introduce me to people and who can help us either learn or help us recruit people in different areas to help us.
Got it. And probably those activities you didn't have to do a lot of in the early stage of having been through Madrona Venture Labs and like the 0 to 1 stage was, you had a lot of reps and sets there.
Yeah. So we brought in Lori, who was the chief merchant of Zulily, as an advisor to help us on the merch stuff. And then she helped us hire a chief merchant. And then we were able to sell divide that team and have and improve the bench there. And then it's that sort of activity. How can we find advisors maybe that can help us recruit and help guide us? And so we can be more proactive versus you start to feel like something could be better or something's broken. And if you wait too long, you're reactive. Whenever I feel like I'm reactive, I get really self-critical. Ah, how could I have been more proactive? What should I have done differently?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that lesson. Joe, I've really enjoyed this conversation. I want to wrap up with the Supersonic Six. This is the rapid fire round.
Cool.
Number one, how much coffee do you drink?
So much coffee. I like lose count. I really, it's probably 5 or 6 cups a day. And I drink at 5 p.m.
Number two, what's one other Seattle company that you're following or studying right now?
I love Skilljar. I like Mystery. I don't know if you know those guys.
Yeah.
And I think they're really scrappy and they've had like their COVID challenges have been different than mine, but I love seeing how companies react to big changes. And I'm really inspired by how they've done that. Yeah. Algorithmia is a really great company too. Awesome people, great products, very different areas, but I love those.
Great ones. Thank you. Number three, who's one Seattle person that you're following or learning from right now?
I've been Ben Gilbert. I used to work with him at Madrona Venture Labs. Give him a shout out to Ben. I love Ben, but I love what he's doing with the podcast. Ben is so talented. He's very positive and energetic and creative and brilliant. And so I miss Ben. I miss working with Ben. I miss talking to Ben. So I've been following his podcast and what they're up to over there at PSL.
Number four, what's the one thing that Seattle needs to improve as a startup hub?
People need to quit their big companies and go start companies. And they need to realize that those companies, the big companies, they will hire you back and you'll probably be hired back into a bigger role. So just get out of there, put yourself out there, really get out of your comfort zone, get scared, do something, really throw yourself in. And even if you fail, you're going to be better off. So please.
Number five, what's one piece of advice you'd give your 20-year-old self?
I would say for me, it was, I was an engineer. I was an introvert. I was engineer in school as a software engineer, a computer science major. You've got all the prerequisites and all the classes. You just end up not well-rounded. And my skill was like dive deep, learn, solve, figure out. And those are strengths. Don't get me wrong. But I would say, hey, Joe, go spend some time figuring out how to leverage other people. Figure out how to get yourself in some teamwork situations or team sports even, or those sorts of things to develop the soft skills earlier and get in to learn that the art of winning through others. 1 + 1 = 3. That's what I would tell myself.
Number six, what can this community do to help you? Or is there anything you want them to take a look at? Anything you want them to check out?
Let's see. I would say, I don't want to sound like a plug, but crowdcow.com/gift or gifts, really for helping us connect it to HR teams or sales organizations or things like this, things where we're all at home now, your employees, your professional contacts, and we're all looking for ways to engage. So I think we're a really good way to do that.
That's awesome. So you can actually gift a customer some product or something right from the site.
That's right. We've got some great gift bundles. Give some people at home some meaty perks.
What could be better than that? Joe, thank you so much for being here and thanks for the conversation.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Hey, it's Adam again. Quick note before you go. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you're enjoying the show as much as I am enjoying making it. If you do like it, please leave a rating or a review. That would help other people find it in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you have any feedback, send me an email, adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com. No underscores, no periods, just adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com.